Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
How are you doing today? Good. So today we're going to complete our calculation. And in particular, we'll discuss Dyson's formula, Wick's formula, and the propagator. So recall our goal was to compute the scattering amplitude up to a normalization. This tells us about, if we square this, we'll get the probability for some initial state, initial momentum eigenstate to evolve into some final momentum eigenstate. We can use this to predict how our system would evolve in time. And the scattering amplitude was formulated in terms of our ladder operators. So that's what our goal of what we want to compute. That's something that's easy to measure experimentally. But when we formulate our theories, we formulate our theories in terms of fields. And so last time we saw that the LSZ reduction formula lets us relate scattering amplitude to a vacuum expectation value of a time-ordered product of fields. So the reason this is useful is that this object is easier to compute. And that's what we're going to learn how to compute today. So notably, this expression, which appears in the LSZ reduction formula, it's not the complete thing, but this is the part we need to learn how to compute. This involves Heisenberg picture fields. So these are Heisenberg picture fields. Now, if we have an interacting theory, in general, we don't know how to solve for the time evolution exactly. For the Klein-Gordon theory, we could. We could solve the Klein-Gordon equation classically, and that let us solve exactly for the time evolution of our field operators. In an interacting theory, in general, we don't know how to do that. So what we're going to do first is relate this Heisenberg picture expression to an interaction picture expression. So here we're in the Heisenberg picture, and here we're in the interaction picture. Now, one of the advantages of the interaction picture is it gives us a handle on how to describe the time evolution. So if we can solve the free theory we're perturbing around, then we can solve for time evolution in the interaction picture. At least perturbatively. So that will be the first thing we do today. And then we'll see that interaction picture vacuum expectation values of the time order product of fields can be computed systematically using Wick's theorem. So this will let us relate a vacuum expectation value, the time ordered product of M fields for arbitrary M, to a vacuum expectation value, the time ordered product of two fields. And one of the last things we'll do today is we'll see that this is in fact the Feynman propagator that you discussed with Bindia. We'll make that connection to what you saw earlier in the course. So this is exactly the same thing you computed in Bindia's final lecture. Okay, so that's where we're going. And any questions on where we're going or what we did last time? Okay. So the first thing we want to do is to rewrite this Heisenberg picture expression in the interaction picture. And to do that, we need to do two things. We need to write the fields in the interaction picture and also the vacuum. OK, so. Yes, what?
Yeah, as we did with Bindia, when we were talking about like the interacting picture, what it was like to deal with time-dependent potential. So I'm wondering how we will like move from the free vacuum to interacting vacuum. Is it that we will like relate both with the time-dependent potential, or I don't know?
That's right. We'll use essentially the same methods. So a key fact that we're going to use to relate these two expressions is that there's a reference time. So there exists a reference time. Which we've often set to be t equal to 0, but I'm going to call it t naught for today's lecture, at which the Heisenberg picture and Schrodinger picture and interaction picture states and operators all agree. So they're all the same at the reference time. And this will be a key fact that we use to make this transition. Other questions? Okay, so the first thing we want to do is relate the Heisenberg picture fields to the interaction picture fields. That's what I call our interaction picture field phi naught. And in general, this is time dependent. Is the interaction picture. And we can write this. So usually this is defined by relating it to the Schrodinger picture field. So this is an e to the I h naught t minus t naught times the Schrodinger picture field. Defined at it's time independent, it's defined at the reference time. And so here I'm assuming that our Hamiltonian is a free Hamiltonian, which I'll call H naught. You can think of this as the Klein-Gordon Hamiltonian plus an interaction, which I'll call H1. This is a this is not quite what we want. The Schrodinger picture does not appear in either what we have or what we want. So we want to relate this interaction picture field to the Heisenberg picture field. But we know how the Schrodinger picture field is related to the Heisenberg picture field. So we have an e to the I h naught t minus t naught. Then e to the minus I h t minus t naught times the Heisenberg picture field. At time t, this can also be written in terms of a time evolution operator in the interaction picture. This can also be written as u t t naught h x t u dagger dagger. My dagger's in the right spot. Okay. Yes. So this time evolution operator here is this combination of the time evolution with the free Hamiltonian and the time evolution with the total Hamiltonian, and it can be written as a time-ordered exponential. Let's write it in general for time evolution from T1 to T2. So this equation lets us relate the Heisenberg picture fields to the interaction picture fields. Note that I will sometimes refer to these as free fields. This is a slight abuse of terminology, but the reason I call them free fields is that they evolve in time in exactly the same way that the free fields do. So this equation will let us write the fields in the interaction picture instead of the Heisenberg picture. Interaction picture. The other thing we need in order to relate this expression, which is what we want to compute, to this expression, which will be easier to compute, is a relationship between omega and zero, the vacuum of the interacting theory and the vacuum of the free theory, like I was asking about earlier. And to do that, we can make the following observation. So we know that for the interacting theory, the annihilation operators annihilate the vacuum at all times. And I'm going to write this equation in the Schrodinger picture. Here we're going to be in the Schrodinger picture. So the annihilation operator will be evaluated at our reference time. And our vacuum will then be time dependent. So this should be zero. It should be zero for any time. And in particular, it should be zero at t equals plus or minus infinity. I can also write this since we know how the vacuum evolves in time. I can also write this as a v of t zero e to the I h. T minus T zero omega at the reference time. Minus sign. So This comes from actually our definition of the annihilation operators and our definition of the vacuum state. The annihilation operators, by definition, annihilate the vacuum at all times. In the free theory, you can write similar equations. We also know that Write this in the Heisman. Yeah, write the same thing. Do we also know that the annihilation operators annihilate the free vacuum at any time? Particularly, they do that at t equals plus or minus infinity. And again, we know the time evolution of the free vacuum. That will just evolve with the free Hamiltonian. So if we write out the explicit time dependence, this is e to the minus I h naught t minus t naught, depending on vacuum state at time zero. Now, we also know that the annihilation operator, the reference time, in the interacting theory is equal to the annihilation operator in the interaction picture at the reference time. So all the states and operators agree at a reference time. So these two operators are the same. And if the vacuum is unique, that means that this state that is annihilated by the vacuum in the interacting theory has to be equal to this state that's annihilated in the last equation, up to some normalization constant. So if the vacuum is unique, which we'll assume it is, then we have that omega is some normalization constant, the limit t goes to minus infinity of, so we need to move this operator to the other side. So I get a e to the plus h times e to the minus h naught, which combines to give us a time evolution operator. We have the h first, so it would be a u dagger. So that would give us then, the I h t minus t naught e to the minus I h naught t minus t naught, 0, which is time evolution operator from minus infinity to 0. So here I've introduced a new notation. I'll also call this u 1 times 0. So up to some normalization, time evolution, these two vacuums are the same.
I didn't understand something over here. So in the second line, you have h naught and h appearing separately, and there's a relative minus sign. And then when you write the time evolution operator, h only appears as h, so
should
be h.
So this should be h1. Thank you. And we can also So here I took the limit t goes to minus infinity. I could also take the limit where t goes to plus infinity. The normalization factors in those two limits don't have to be the same. So for the ket vacuum, which appears on the right, so it's like an initial state, we'll take the limit t goes to minus infinity. For the Brahe vacuum, we'll take the limit t goes to plus infinity, where we might get a different normalization constant. So we'll write omega, the Brahe. Instead, we could just take the conjugate of this equation, but we'll choose something different so that in our Brahe vacuum, we were at t equals plus infinity. In our ket vacuum, we're in t equals minus infinity. So we can write the Brahe vacuum as some, in general, different normalization factor. It's a limit t goes to plus infinity of u infinity 0. Acting on the Brahe free vacuum state. So this is our relationship between the vacuum of the interacting theory and the vacuum of the free theory. And the only assumption we've made is that it makes sense to use the interaction picture, that we can, in some sense, describe our interacting theory as a perturbation of the free theory.
Could you explain why there's a normalization factor in the first place?
Well, so I know that the vacuum state is unique up to normalization. So if I have this operator that annihilates vacuum state for all p's, I know it's the vacuum state up to some normalization, and same here. So these have to be proportional. They don't have to be equal. Yes, Yaroslav?
So if I add a potential that has like two wells which are the same energy level, then this one like all over.
As I've argued here, yes. I'm assuming it's unique. You can generalize what we're doing to the case where we have degenerate vacuum. And that's something we'll look at later in future courses. Okay. So let's combine our results. We know how to write the vacuum state and the field operators in the interaction picture. Let's combine our results. Okay, so what we are trying to compute is the vacuum expectation value, the time ordered product of fields. In the Heisenberg picture. And we want to write that in the interaction picture. For now, let's assume that things are time ordered. Let's assume t1 is greater than t2, greater than tn. This is not a strong assumption. If it's not true, we can just relabel things. If that's the case, we can write this as replace our Brahe vacuum with 0 u infinity 0. Then our first field operator with, we have a u one zero times the interaction picture field operator, shall call phi zero of x1. Then I have here a u dagger, but u dagger is also evolution backwards in time. So I can also write this as just u 0 1. and so on, up to phi 0 of xn. U 0 minus infinity 0. And I also need to include the normalization factors in I and NF. Okay. Now note that everything here is time ordered. At least if I combine these two operators. So I can write this as an I and F 0, U infinity 1, I 0, X 1. The U 0, 1 will combine with a U 2, 0 to become a U 1, 2. Y 0 of x 2 up to u n minus infinity. So here I've just used the composition law for time evolution. Time evolution from time 1 to 2 and then from time 2 to time 3 is the same as time evolution from time 1 to time 3. Now, in this expression, everything is time ordered. I have the earliest time over here in this time evolution operator, and I have a field operator at time n, which is the earliest, and so on, and another time evolution operator. So this expression is time ordered. So I can insert a time ordering. Here.
That should be U12.
U1. Yes. U12. Two is earlier than one.
First line all the way on the right, are you missing a time evolution operator?
This time evolution operator?
Yeah, should there be two? Because on the left-hand side, you both fit into zero and then to the time one.
You're right, thank you. I left off. Should be a U, U zero minus infinity, and U zero
n.
So they combine to give us this. This expression is time ordered, so I can insert a time ordering symbol. Let me not write the whole thing again. I'll just note that this is time ordered, so I can insert a T here. And if I have a time ordering symbol, that tells me what order to put the operators in. So I'm free to move them around by hand, and I'm not changing the expression. Time ordering tells us what order to evaluate the operators. And in particular, if I'm free to commute things or move things around by hand because of the time ordering symbol, I can combine this u minus infinity n, then there'll be a u n n minus 1, a u 2 1, a u 1 infinity, and this will all combine to be the time ordered product of fields. Times a time evolution operator from minus infinity to infinity. Again, just using this composition of time ordering.
Okay.
operators. Sarah?
Sorry, in the first line where we have the u infinity 0 and the u 1 0, and then on the other side it's u 0 1, should those be switched around? The u?
Yes, they should. Thank you. Thank you. U 0 1. Yes, didn't look combined properly. Okay, so we're almost there. The last thing we want to deal with are these normalization factors. And we can deal with these normalization factors by making the assumption. So we'll assume that our interacting vacuum is unit normalized. If we do that, we make that assumption, can again relate the interacting vacuum to the free vacuum. So this tells us that 0, ni and f, u infinity 0, u 0 minus infinity 0 is equal to 1, or ni and f is equal to 1 over 0 u infinity minus infinity 0. And so that gives us our final expression relating the Heisenberg picture vacuum expectation value to the interaction picture. Let me write that out. So we have T I 1 I n is 0 time ordered product of phi 1 phi n. These are free fields. Times this u, which I'll write in a more useful way. So u can be written in terms of the interaction Hamiltonian. We are generally going to be interested in the case where the interaction Lagrangian is a polynomial in fields. If that's the case, then H1 is equal to minus the integral, spatial integral of Lint. This will hold even more generally than the case we're interested in, but we will exclusively consider the case where L is a polynomial in the fields and not their derivatives. And that guarantees this. So if that's the case, then we can write the interaction picture time evolution operator as a time-ordered exponential of the space-time integral of the interaction Lagrangian, which is a more useful way to write things if we're going to specify our theory by writing down a Lagrangian. So I can write this as then the exponential of I, that's the space-time integral of Lint. And the denominator is the same thing without any extra fields. And so this is our first key result for today's lecture. This is this, or the expansion of this, is what's usually referred to as Dyson's formula. This kind of thing. So far, we've made no approximations We've just made a few assumptions, but we have, if not, expanded in any small parameter. So these two expressions are equivalent, assuming, of course, that we could compute either side. And in general, we can't compute either side exactly. But the nice thing about writing the expression for the vacuum expectation value of the time-ordered product of fields in the interaction picture is that it is feasible, and in some cases not very difficult, to compute the right-hand side perturbatively. So, and in particular, if we expand the exponential in a power series, write this as 1 I integral d4x L int plus higher order terms. Each term in the expansion of both the numerator and the denominator will be of this form. There'll be some extra integrals and maybe some extra numerical factors, but in terms of the fields we'll be evaluating, it will be the vacuum expectation value, the time-ordered product of n fields. This will be n plus however many extra fields we get from the interaction Lagrangian. Remember, we're assuming the case of interest is where the interaction Lagrangian is a polynomial of fields. For now, you can take that because that's the simplest interesting case. There's other reasons why polynomials are interesting that we'll explore later. If that's the case, then all we need to compute any term, the expansion of the numerator or denominator, is an expression like this. Here's that.
To me, it's still not clear how we commuted the u's on like second line to third line.
So the time ordering of any two operators this is equal to the time ordering of the operators in the other order. So time ordering tells us the operators should appear in a particular order. We can write them in any order we like. Grouping everything together like this is particularly useful. It makes our calculations easier. But here, the operators do not appear in time order. So we have some operators at some times. And here, this is a combination of operators at all times. Okay, this is a good place to break, so let's resume in 5 minutes.
So that's what you mean when you write that. I mean, this is the most general like class of series.
Like, where you only need to be able to do
it. Yeah. I mean, I was finishing.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I think I started.
It was hard. It was the deadline.
I wanted to ask about the expansion of 25, but we assume that we can expand it.
And an important question is a conversion. We'll talk about the core feature sources, but despite the fact that hasn't emerged, the low order becomes a series for a given excellent process. There's lots of interesting topics to say about why those are. That's right. At some point,
I think this is just a.
Yes, if you choose minus infinity, then they are literally.
So running into another.
Maybe that's right.
It has like my regular
The field is operating.
What is that?
Start with time order. So.
You want to?
That shit's closing cars. So quickly.
Oh, good.
They want to go downhills?
No! What the fuck is that?
Okay, let's resume. Okay, so if we want to compute these vacuum expectation values of time order products of fields, we can do so using perturbation theory by going to the interaction picture. And to compute each term in the numerator or denominator, we need to compute a vacuum excitation value of a time-ordered product of free fields or interaction picture fields. So that's what we'll do next. One comment I'd like to make before we do that is that I haven't said anything about the convergence of this series. And this is something we'll come back to in future courses. I'd just like to point out here that I've made no arguments that this series converges. And in general, it doesn't, for reasons we'll see later in future courses. But this is something that we will discuss further. And I just don't want you to be under the impression that what we're doing is always a convergent series. It won't. There'll be some physical explanations we can give for why, in general, we don't expect this to be a convergent series. We'll come back to that later. Even though it doesn't converge, it still does give a useful approximation. Justifying this mathematically is hard, but I can appeal to experiment at this point. So you can use these techniques that we're going to describe to perturbatively calculate scattering amplitude and check that the predictions agree with experiment. And in fact, you find remarkable agreement. In fact, some of the most precise agreement between theory and experiment is built on these techniques. In quantum electrodynamics, they can make match predictions and experiments to 11 digits, which is better than anything else in human history. So it works. Why is a question we'll come back to. OK, so we want to compute the vacuum expectation value of the time-ordered product of free fields. And well, it's a time-ordered product. And that's not directly the easiest thing to compute. We were going to take an expression like this. We're going to take an expression like the one we've been studying. And try to compute it. Well, our basically the only technique we have is using the commutation relations. So we can do that repeatedly to turn this time ordered product into a normal ordered product. Because after we use the commutation relations, we're trying to push all our annihilation operators to the vacuum on the right and our creation operators to the vacuum on the left. That's the only technique we have so far to compute this. So what Wick's theorem does is it generalizes this procedure. It tells us how to relate a time-ordered product of fields to a normal ordered product of fields. And computing the vacuum expectation value of a normal ordered product of fields is straightforward. We know that the vacuum expectation value of a normal ordered product of any number of fields is zero, as long as we have at least one field. So that's why Wick's theorem is useful. It lets us take what we want to compute, turn it into something that's easy to compute. Okay. And Wick's theorem, as I'm going to present it, is a statement about operators. Let me first present what Wick's theorem is, and then we'll see why it's true. So Wick's theorem says that the time ordered product of n fields, and note that I'm the fields here are free fields or interaction picture fields. So earlier in the lecture, I was careful to distinguish which ones are the free fields by putting the zero subscripts. I generally won't do that going forward if you have questions asked, but if there's a free vacuum, then the fields that appear there are free fields. Okay, so Wick's theorem says that the time-ordered product of fields is equal to the sum of the normal ordered products of all contractions of fields. Okay, so we know what normal ordering is. What is a contraction? So let me define what a contraction is in a minute. So contraction is related to the commutator. And we can get a precise definition by looking at this general statement for n equals 2. Let's try to prove this for n equals 2, and we can see what we'll get on the right-hand side, and that will suggest how to generalize. For n equals 2, we're looking at this expression. Sorry, no expectation of us. And the way we can relate this expression to a normal ordered product of fields is by breaking up phi 1 and phi 2 to the parts involving creation operators and the parts involving annihilation operators. So let me write phi 1 plus being the part of phi 1 that involves the creation operators. So this will be p3k for 2 pi cubed 2ek ak plus to the I k dot x1. So remember, phi sub 1 means phi of x1. And phi 1 minus will be the other part, arc and containing the annihilation operators. Okay. And we can do the same thing for phi 2. And if we want to take T phi 1 by 2 and write it as a normal ordered product, what we can do is we can expand both phi 1 and phi 2 into the parts, break it up into the parts containing the creation operators and annihilation operators. So this becomes phi 1 plus phi 1 minus times phi 2 plus phi 2 minus. So there's four terms. And most of them are normal ordered. But one is not. And which one of these is not normal ordered? This is, here I'm assuming that T1 is greater than T2. If that's the case, then phi 1, phi 2 is the norm, is the time order product of fields. Which one of these terms is not normal ordered? The third one? Why?
Creation operator. You want to send the creation operator to
the lab. That's right. Good. Good. Thank you. Here, Chung. So this term. This term is not normal ordered. So we can rewrite this as phi 1 plus phi 2 plus phi 1 plus phi 2 minus phi 2 plus phi 1 minus plus the commutator. And we see that this expression is a time ordered product is equal to the normal ordered product. Equal to the normal ordered product plus this commutator, at least if T1 is greater than T2. So here I'm putting in a Heaviside step function. This is the result if T1 is greater than T2. And if T2 is greater than T1, then we need to switch 1 and 2. So we have phi 2 minus phi 1 plus if T2 is greater than T1. And this part here, this is the contraction, which I'll denote by phi 1, phi 2, with a line connecting them. So that equals the pink box. So let me write it over here again. So the contraction of two fields is equal to this commutator. Phi 1 minus phi 2 plus okay, and so the commutator is a complex number, or an operator proportional to the identity. So that means that if we are going to compute the vacuum expectation value of T of phi 1, phi 2, we get the vacuum expectation value of the normal ordered product plus the vacuum expectation value of the commutator, contraction. And you can simplify the right-hand side of this expression. And what does it simplify to?
Here, John? The second term.
Just the second term. And the second term, this is just a number, not an operator, so we can just then use the fact that 0, 0, 0 is 1. So we just get the contraction. So the contraction is equal to this vacuum expectation value. And as we'll see in a minute, this is also equal to the Feynman propagator. That Bindu told you about last week. Okay. So this is the general statement. And to be clear what I mean by that statement, let's look at what Wick's theorem tells us about the time ordered product of three fields. So Wick's theorem says that this time ordered product is the sum of all possible contractions of the fields normal ordered. Every contraction acts on exactly two fields. So there are four possible ways we can contract these fields. You could contract zero fields. We could contract phi 1 with phi 2 and leave phi 3 uncontracted. We could contract phi 1 with phi 3. Or we could contract phi 2 with phi 3. So for this case, there's a term with no contractions and three terms with one contraction. And all the terms have at least one contracted field, which tells us something about the vacuum expectation value of this expression. What does it tell us about the vacuum expectation value? Good. Some of you indicating with your hands, but if anyone wants to volunteer out loud, yes.
It's going to be zero?
Zero, that's right. If we have any uncontracted fields, we have some non-trivial operators inside of our normal ordering. And normal ordering pushes all the annihilation operators to the right, where it annihilates the Ket vacuum, and the creation operators to the left, where it annihilates the Bra vacuum. So these terms will vanish inside an expectation value. Okay. All right, so let's sketch a proof of why this is true. I won't fill in all the gaps, but I think it's illustrative to think about why this is true. The simplest way to prove this is by induction. We've already proved a base case. So let's assume it works. Fields, and we want to try to prove it for n plus 1. So if it holds for n fields, then if we look at the time-ordered product of n plus 1 fields. And again, let's assume that they're already time-ordered without loss of generality. If they're not, we can reorder. If they're already time ordered, then we can apply, and we assume it holds for n fields, then we can apply Wick's theorem to the last n fields. So we can write this as phi 1 times the sum of all contractions involving phi 2 up to phi m. And what we would need to do is show that this commuting putting the phi 1 part in normal order also gives us the missing contractions, the contractions between phi 1 and all the other fields. To do that, we need to break up phi into two parts, because half of phi is already in a normal ordered part. So the we can write this as phi 1 plus phi 1 minus. And times the sum over here. Same. And this term with the creation operators on the left is already normal ordered, so we just need to push the phi 1 to the right. So we need this one is okay. This one we need to move to the right. And so phi 1 minus the sum of contractions let's look at a particular term. So there's many terms here. Let's look at the term with no contractions. So one term is this term where there's no contractions. And to write this in normal ordered, we need to commute phi 1 minus past everything. And after we do that, it will be normal ordered. And to commute it past everything, we basically have to commute it past phi 2, and then phi 3, and then phi 4. So we get phi 1, phi n plus 1, plus commutator phi 1 minus with phi 2 plus, normal order of the rest. Plus commutators with each of the other ones all the way up to the commutator of phi 1 minus with phi n plus 1 plus. And this term will give us the term in the sum of all contractions where there's no contractions between phi 1 and the other fields. This will give us a contraction between phi 1 and phi 2, and so on. Ralph?
I guess it's just not obvious to me why, because we're only looking at the phi 1 minus term, so but we've introduced phi 1 entirely in the right-hand side there. So should that phi 1 be in the first contraction? Or should there just be a phi 1 minus at the end of it?
Oh, you're right, yes. We need the phi plus part to get this term here. So we need to have otherwise we'll only have part of that term. Thank you. So we get the term with no contractions between phi 1 and other fields, and each of the possible contractions with phi 1 and all the other fields. So it's not a foolproof, but that's the basic idea of how you would go through and prove this. So
done.
Yes.
It says in your notes that we can bring phi 1 plus inside the normal ordered symbols because it only creates, because it only contains creation operators. Can
that's
you
right.
Is that?
Yes. So normal ordering means push all the creation operators to the left and all the annihilation operators to the right. Mm-hmm. And all creation operators commute among themselves. So if we have something normal ordered and we have an A dagger next to it, this is something. This is equal to the normal ordering of the A dagger with the whatever that is. This is already in the normal ordering.
Thank you.
Okay. So that's Wick's theorem. And it's a statement about operators. So we didn't need to use a vacuum expectation value anywhere to prove this, the statement about operators. But in practice, most of the time we're going to use it is to evaluate vacuum expectation values, where we have vacuum state on either side of this expression. So in general, all possible contractions involves lots of terms. Some will be completely uncontracted, some will be partially contracted, and there might be a few terms, or there might not be, that are completely contracted. But only the completely contracted ones will survive when we take a vacuum expectation value. So only completely contracted survive vacuum expectation value, or VEV. And so that means, well, finding all the possible contractions there can be a lot of possible contractions, but the completely contracted is a much smaller set. So there are four terms here. There are a lot more terms if we have more fields, but there's a small number that are completely contracted. So in particular, we're interested in computing the time-ordered product of four fields. Wick's theorem says that as an operator, we can write this time-ordered product as a sum of all possible contractions. But because we have the vacuum expectation value, there's only a few terms that we want to compute, those that are completely contracted. So there's not that many terms like that. So we have to contract all the fields. So if we contract phi 1 with phi 2, that tells us we have to also contract phi 3 with phi 4. Or if we contract phi 1 with phi 3, then we have to contract phi 2 with phi 4. Or if we contract phi 1 with phi 4, then we have to contract phi 2 with phi 3. So only three terms here compared to the four terms we had already when we were looking at the operator version of Wick's theorem for three fields. So this is something we can do and very quickly. We can use this to compute this expectation value. Explicitly going through and using the commutation relations would be extremely time consuming. So that's why this is useful. Okay. So we almost have everything we need to compute a scattering amplitude. The LSZ reduction formula, Dyson's formula, Wick's theorem. Let's just relate a scattering amplitude to this contraction. And I claim that this contraction, or the vacuum expectation value of the time ordered product of two fields, is equal to the Feynman propagator that you saw with Bindia last week. So that's the last thing we need to compute these scattering amplitudes. And we'll put so after we have that, we'll have all the ingredients we need in principle to compute these scattering amplitudes. And tomorrow we'll put them together and see what that all of this tells us about what a scattering amplitude is. Okay, so in the first tutorial with me, you showed that this expectation value with no time ordering was just an integral of e to the minus I p dot x minus y. So that tells us what the time-ordered vacuum expectation value is explicitly. So this will just be this integral, and we'll have two terms, e to the minus I p dot x minus y times every side function if, so this is if x0 is greater than y0, and if y is later, then we just have the same thing but with x and y switched. And this is one of the expressions for the propagator that you saw with Bindia last week. So to recall, what you showed is that you could relate this expression to the following contour integral. Let's write it like this. The Feynman contour. So we could write it as a contour integral like this in the complex P0 plane. This final expression, I'm missing an exponential here, this final expression has two poles on the real P naught line, one at EP and one at minus EP. Bindia called these, I think, omega and minus omega. Same thing. And she showed you how to relate this expression to this expression by closing the contour and seeing which poles were enclosed. So if you, if P naught, if X naught is greater than Y naught, if then we should close the contour, which it will be close to a real, the contour along the real line down here. We should close it down here because here P naught will have a negative imaginary part, and we want to have a negative exponential, negative argument of the exponential for the additional part of the contour to not contribute. So if that's the case, if X naught is greater than Y naught, we get, you see, we get this term, which accounts for the pole at plus EP. So this is telling us that we're enclosing this pole if X naught is greater than Y naught. So our contour goes above this pole, and in order to match this term, like you saw with Bindiya. And to get this term, over here, we're enclosing the pole at minus EP. So our contour should go like this. And we close it down, close it up here if Y naught is greater than X naught. So our explicit calculations match the Feynman prescription for the contour that you saw with Bindiya. You saw that there were multiple choices, the advanced, retarded, or Feynman. We computed this. And this agrees with the general form you saw with Bindiya if we make the choice of contour that's the Feynman contour. So this is equal to the Feynman propagator. And recall one important property. This was one of the ways that Aldo introduced Green's functions or propagators to you, is that this propagator is a Green's function of the Klein-Gordon operator. So that means that d squared plus m squared acting on the Feynman propagator is a delta function. There turns out with our choice of conventions, there's an I, but it's proportional to a delta of x minus y. And this property will be useful for us later when we're doing explicit calculations. So and to see this, if we apply, in this last form, if we apply the Klein-Gordon operator here, the derivative brings down a p squared with a minus sign from the i's. So if we act with a derivative on this, we just get a minus p squared plus an m squared. There's another way that we often write the Feynman propagator. It's often also written as I e to the minus p dot x minus y, with no explicit indication of the contour, but as p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon. And here, there's an implicit limit as epsilon goes to zero. people will commonly see this. This is often used. It indicates this I epsilon. We can think about, instead of deforming the contour slightly, we infinitesimally deform the poles. This I epsilon will push the pole, push this pole slightly below the real line, and the other pole slightly above the real line. So it's equivalent. Okay. Any questions about this? So hopefully this is familiar from Bindiya. So just wanted to make that connection that what we're computing is exactly one of the Green's functions that Bindiya taught you about last week. And comparing which residues we need to enclose tells us that we need to choose the Feynman contour to match with what you saw last week.
And so would I be able to come up with a Feynman prescription if I didn't know the answer in the canonical formalism?
Well, you could also compute this answer in the path integral formalism, and careful treatment of time ordering in the path integral formulation would tell us that we have to make this get the same answer. Another argument has to do with which frequencies are allowed in the past and the future. So the Feynman propagator amounts to imposing boundary conditions where you only allow positive frequencies in the future and negative frequencies in the past. So that physically makes sense. But ultimately, it's hard to argue with the math. You can compute this explicitly, and it gives you the Feynman contour. To me, that's the most convincing argument, although you can make others. Okay. So, in principle, we have all the ingredients we need to compute scattering amplitude, or Heisenberg picture vacuum expectation value of a time ordered product of fields. And what we're going to do next time is see how to do that. So there's lots of steps in this process. We could go through all these steps explicitly in some examples, but we're going to choose very simple examples and try to come up with a faster and easier but equivalent way of doing these computations. And that is based on Feynman's idea. So next time what we're going to see is that each term in the perturbative expansion can be mapped to a Feynman diagram. And there are Feynman rules that we can use to compute the quantities we're interested in, either a scattering amplitude or a vacuum expectation value of a time-ordered product of fields. And if we are interested in computing that at some fixed order using perturbation theory, there are Feynman rules that will tell us which diagrams to draw and what mathematical expressions to associate with each diagram. And doing that will be much easier than going through much easier but equivalent to doing the procedure we've outlined so far. So that's where we're going next. We will recap what we've done, but repackage it in a different and practically more useful way. Okay, so that's all for today, and the tutorial this afternoon, we will re-examine this and slightly generalize it. So we'll look at complex scalar fields, which are some interesting physics as well. All right. Thank you.